On the way, just before coming down here, I just got very angry, just really mad at how it looks like the devil is really systematically stealing the content of our words. We've talked about this before in rhetoric, how what words mean has been changed, things have been taken out, other things have been put in. Our words have been stolen from us. Our language has been stolen from us. And that is very frightening because it is language with which, language is what we use to think with. And what made me angry was something, I think it was started last night when Rich said, how many people, you say, Father who art in heaven, how many ADC mothers can get a conception of that? You know? AIDS-dependent children, mothers. Mm-hmm. On ADC, AIDS-dependent children, can relate to that at all. Those children, how do they relate to that? Now that's just one word. And what words do we have, say, in the Bible to express what God means and what Christ means? Father, mother, husband, bride, son, brother, sister. All those things have been emptied or are in the process of being emptied. On the way down, our Father who art in heaven, our Father, you know, how many people worldwide have a conception of what that is? That they would want a Father in heaven. Hi, Reed. Good to see you. You know, how many have a meaning for that word that is full of life? Who art in heaven? Hallowed be thy name. Hallowed. How many things are hallowed? I mean, what do we hallow? To where that we can say, well, I hallow this, and so hallowed be God's name, it's even more. Well, how many things do we hallow? Name doesn't mean much anymore, except on a legal contract of thy kingdom come. We don't have kingdom. The sense that there is a guiding, you know, a single guiding will. We have a committee, be thy name. I mean, what? Committee? Bureaucracy? Thy will be done. Will, I don't know too much about philosophy, but will is a concept that is being emptied too, that I will to do something. It's getting very fuzzy what that means. On earth as it is in heaven, and earth is what you make it. There's nothing definite really being referred to by many people when they say earth. Give us this day our daily wonder bread. You know, they take 17 nutrients out and put 6 back in, and then it's wonder bread. You know, bread, wine, what, you know, food, daily bread. We don't have a sense of the being on a getting daily bread. We've got, why we have all the bread we eat, and what does that mean? We're plenty. We live in a greenhouse in this country. What does daily bread mean? Expectancy, hope, trust that's linked with that word. Forgive us our trespasses. Forgiveness is not a term that means much to any people. Trespasses or sins are turned into either a legal term, its environment causes them to break certain laws and so forth, or a medical term. There's not that term has been emptied. And on and on and on. And it's infuriating. What do the words mean again? Freedom, I think, if you took a poll, freedom would mean the definition of license for most people. License. It's okay to do anything that or doesn't hurt a non-consenting person or something like that. Adult. I don't want to be an adult if that's, you know, adult apartments or something like that, and an adult bar. My God, who wants to be an adult? You know, if that's it. Well, it's infuriating. paying attention. Don't let people steal your words. There's some things I was going to write down. I was telling Tom, I felt today this is going to be the last regular session on this. It's going to be the beginning, I hope, again, of the discussion. I was going to write down a 15-minute statement, and then that's that, and I started writing. It'll take a little longer than that, maybe. In all eternity, in a grain of sand, Blake said that, right? Looked at a grain of sand and he saw all eternity there. You pay attention to almost anything and you'll see connections with everything, you know, everything. This is another one of the books. Every time we go through the books, I realize why we chose them. There is so much to strike fire off of in this book, as well as the last one. We've got these two fellows, the kinds of questions they're asking. And then we've got ourselves, and we're trying to establish, remember, a metaphorical relationship between the book and ourselves, where we are the abstraction and it's the concrete that is going to lighten up, help explain that abstract thing that we are, chaos, that confusion, that fantasy. I think with the hope to make a comedy of our lives instead of a tragedy or a pathetic, something pathetic or something fantastic, but to make a comedy of it. Okay, in a sense, I should say, in a sense, the book is about how two extreme people come to terms with loss. We mentioned that before. I thought I'd try to say something about that. Zorba hurts through loss and then comes to terms with loss. Now, Zorba hurts through loss and then plunges himself into the next moment. He experiences the loss with all the depth of its hurt, and then at a certain point he plunges into the next moment. He is not just like a child. We've said some things like he sees with a child's eyes. He's not just like a child. A child gets bored sooner. A child gets bored sooner. The rock is beautiful the first time it rolls down a hill. The second time it does, it's just a rock. Zorba has an eye for original joys. To Zorba, each thing that strikes him is original. In it, there is an original joy and an original suffering. The suffering doesn't last as long because his heart is so exercised, so scarred. His heart is so exercised and scarred. Boss is as soft like his hands. Boss's heart is as soft as his hands, tender to a fault. His heart is attacked by fear and anxiety of loss and pain, and this erodes the heart. Anxiety erodes the heart. Anxiety is not something that breaks your heart. It's something that wears it down. Does that make sense? I mean, this stuff that I wrote down came so fast and came in such a fire, as some of it's going to be poetry. So it's hang in there. But anxiety erodes the heart, just wears it away. Fear wears it away. There's nothing definite to hit the heart, to break it so it can be healed again. There's no, good heavens, you have an arm, but it doesn't look like it. Look at Tom right now. That's an image in about two poems of mine, just what happens in your mind when you see someone without an arm, you know. And the image is in here when Boss sees Zorba. But it's a different, you don't use it that way. But the shattering of expectations is going to be incredible. Remember how if you want to make a guy lose his mind, you break his expectation of tendency, his understanding of tendency. No longer does the world tend to do things, right? And I even thought during my evil days of making a movie that would blow people's minds, literally, by setting up certain situations and then not throwing in an opposite rather than what's expected. Just a continual one, fast. Terrible idea, demonic idea. I didn't do it, obviously. Okay, the suffering in Zorba doesn't last so long because his heart is so exercised, so scarred. Boss is as soft like his hands, tender to a fault. His heart is attacked by fear and anxiety of loss and pain. This erodes the heart. Zorba's cracks and is healed. And sometimes he can go back and can find that particular sorrow and feel them again, new, and or the particular joys. And those joys are that which bind the broken heart back up. The joy comes in over the sorrow. In a sense, without the loss, there isn't the joy. Without the suffering, there isn't the joy. Because the joy is what rests on the break in our hearts. Zorba doesn't pay attention to his heart. Boss tends his own poorly and wraps his heart in wax. At first of the book, and then it emerges a bit toward the end. But Boss is still up for grabs at the end. He's still playing it safe. He's still, in a sense, caught in timidity. And it's funny that Zorba calls to him out of his grave to come and see a green stone, this time in the shape of a widow. Now, did you remember the letter that Zorba wrote? Or Zorba didn't write. He had the letter written. Zorba's wife had the letter written. And you know what widows meant through the whole book. Well, now Zorba's wife is a widow. And she asks him to come. The shape of a widow, his in a centuri. We are given no clue as to what Boss will do. Will he spend the night with a widow? It is a question. Whether he will go or not is a very big question. What he should do there is another question, and we're going to talk about that now. Zorba now hits the nail. We're going to kind of shift the subject, but it's the same subject. Zorba hits the nail on the head in saying Boss's problem is understanding. Remember that whole series of passages? It's toward the end. Boss's problem is understanding. He has no folly. That's the problem with you, Boss. You understand. You should have folly. Madness. And the strange thing is that Zorba had problems in that arena too. Boss wouldn't go to the widow because he had no folly, no madness. He wouldn't follow the jade's body to bed. I am all for folly. But the greatest folly, absurdity, freedom of inutility, as Elul would say, would be not to cake the widow in wax, maim yourself by Buddhist indifference, or maim yourself with guilt for having responded, seen, smelled, heard, and felt the thunk of the woman in your heart, head, and bowels. But not to follow the necessary change of feelings. Not to maim yourself, but not to follow the, quote, necessary chain of feelings into the widow's bed, as Zorba would have done. And not to make a philosophic system, as Zorba did, to justify, parentheses, and then make doing his thing necessary to being justified within his system. Is not to make a system that Zorba did. Zorba's problem, he did think he understood. He thought he understood what should be done, what a man should be. He thought he understood. He didn't have enough folly. Now that sounds crazy, but Zorba didn't have enough folly. Zorba didn't have enough folly. He thought he had, but he didn't.
He said one of the greatest follies was the encasing in wax.
No, well, that's a folly too. Crazy.
But the following
That is not folly enough. That's crazy. Okay, absurdity. To follow your instincts is necessary. It's not free. Okay, necessity, you're not free if you follow necessity. If I feel like I must do this, my instincts tell me to do this, and I do it, that's not freedom. I've created a system whereby following up that is necessary. That is not in any sense absurd. I've created a system that makes that the only sensible thing to do.
Just like encasing in wax, just reversed.
Well, I won't speak now on that because my head is right now in another... I'm taking it from another angle and I don't want to jump over where your question is. Okay. It's a good question. I did mention it in here. That there is... There is folly in that. There is folly. But not the way Zorba means it.
Is there folly in following necessity? Or setting up a system that follows necessity?
I think it robs you of your freedom. I think it does. I think somehow we have to understand what Christ would have us do in terms of folly and not necessity.
Where is Zorba's lack of?
Because he's not absurd enough. He does go ahead and try to understand and make a system whereby what he does is sensible, the only sensible thing to do. The completely absurd thing to do is, and it is what I'm saying, is the completely absurd thing to do is not, don't mean yourself to respond. See, smell, and hear, and feel the thunk of the widow in your heart, and in your head, and in your stomach, and not respond. As if chained to a kind of necessity, and jump in bed with her. The point isn't to do as boss and cut your heart out. You know, it's not to cut your heart out. But it's to where it's again a theme that I've mentioned before, and it's a new one for this year. I haven't ever used it before, but that to see the same thing as Zorba, but not to do this, make the same conclusion as to what that means for my action. To see the same thing. The Christian is not supposed to go around telling stories that going to bed with voluptuous widows is no fun, is not pleasurable, would not be exciting, is horribly, you know, is filthy. To see that widow, that voluptuous widow, and not to go ahead and act and to do the necessary, not to get suckered into a kind of necessity that we don't have to get suckered into. Now, this is awfully hard. Let me go on a ways and we'll come back. It sounds crazy. The whole thing sounds crazy. To allow yourself to... How could I? And you say, does anybody do that? Yes, indeed. You know. Yes, yeah.
That sounds to me a lot like that, where you say that basically man is evil, and that, you know, that's getting into man is basically a corrupt, evil person, and only through the grace of Christ can he hope to ever even think of being another way. And it's not folly in the eyes of men, but then the eyes of men are corrupt. But it is folly in the fact that here we are in the world and of it, but not of it.
Mm-hmm. I think being in the water and not getting wet, that line from Karamazov is kind of what I'm talking about here. And being in the world and not of it, where in the hell else are we going to be but in the world, you see? And if we're going to be here, we're going to have to see it, to see the world, not to create a sort of encase the world in wax so that we aren't tempted. You see? Yeah.
It makes me think of where it was in Scripture you're talking, or the commandments of doing something that should be responding, and it's just as evil to think that. But what, and I had to think about that. Where does that fit in?
Okay, with that passage, yeah. Go ahead.
But it does.
You make it, okay.
In that, you said that it's not only the action, but it's what kind of conclusion you see.
Mm-hmm.
And you see because hopefully by God's grace some of those senses are preserved that we've been given. So you see. But what I see doesn't, I don't draw the same conclusions as what somebody else might see, hopefully. And then I'm not drawn into having to see those conclusions and having to make a response to them.
That's right.
And so there, then the thought isn't there. Oftentimes
mm-hmm.
it is, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But hopefully it doesn't have to be. And so we don't have to, in guarding against that thought, we don't have to maim and take away all of those senses.
That's right. That's right. And that is where Zorba is right. When the maimed don't get into paradise, that sense. Because the maiming is not the point. It is not the point to maim ourselves. And to see and not make. Yeah, well, you said it best. You link this up with the to think adultery is adultery, but the point is to get that something can come in between the thinking, between the voluptuous widow and the thinking adultery, and if not right after, when we start to recognize certain things about ourselves and not take ourselves so damn seriously, is that I've thought it, now I've got to follow up on it, or create a system to where it's right. In the strong name of honesty, I've got to, or in the strong name of Zeus, marriage agency, the poor girl is really hurting, I should give her some comfort, which is something that Zorba does here, doesn't he? You see, now that's some real twist in thinking. Now, when saying sounds crazy, it sounds mad, and it is. It is mad. It is really folly to approach the widow the way I've been talking about. It can be divine madness. It can be divine madness, which is far more sensible than men's sensibleness. God's folly is wiser than men. Remember? I don't know, is that in Romans? God's folly is wiser than men. Yeah. To choose not to respond to certain things with certain actions, with a certain, quote, natural actions, is freedom. And can be. And allows you, one of the crazy things is it allows you to be enthusiastic about more of the widow than her musk. More of the widow. It's not something that you're sacrificing, this incredible sacrifice, that you get to be with more. What's necessary doesn't make a difference. Now, what is necessary, and I don't know, I haven't thought this through. What is necessary doesn't make a difference in a person's life. It just brings it up to zero. Now, what's necessary doesn't make a difference in a person's life. It just brings it up to zero. I need food. Get it. It's nothing, extra. Now, if I eat a meal as if it isn't necessary, it may be necessary, which brings me up to zero, but there is a way of eating every meal as a feast, like that chicken today. Every once in a while you owe it to the world to eat in private. You really do. Go off by yourself on a chicken dinner, even Colonel Sanders, baby, and get the Tom Jones banquet pears. A pear is really good. Get a watermelon. Like Zorba, but don't do that to people. People aren't watermelons. But to where it's a feast. Now, the necessity part of it was part of it, but there's grace there, and super added, made me jolly. I got more energy out of that food. I mean, my stomach, it's going to take at least a half an hour, is it? Nutrition experts? A half an hour for that energy to get into me? That's another beautiful theme to work with in here, about how the food becomes spirit, you know. And, oh, it's a whole series, but that's another thing. But it's just, that's another thing you could do for a week, you know, more than a week. But, you know, right away, that food can be grace, you know, to me. I don't have to wait for this strength a half an hour. There is a spiritual thing in that food, too. It's not just necessary, you know. Okay, this takes a lot of thinking. What is necessary doesn't make a difference in a person's life. It gets it up to zero, survival. And we've used that theme before. Survival isn't the point. Life is the point. You know, survival isn't the point. Life is the point. Survival is quantitative. Life is qualitative. I read something in Barclay's Greek words. Eternal is a word of quality, not so much duration of time. There is something to think about for a long time. Eternity is a word of quality, not merely a long duration of time, infinite duration of time. Eternity can begin now. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. The eternal can happen now, you know. The quality can happen now. And that's straight gospel. That isn't me shooting, you know, probing. This is gospel. There is a life, an eternal life. People are having eternal lives right now. Now here's another thing. When the boss went to bed with a widow, even though it was liberating for him, and it was an Easterish morning, remember it happened on Easter. Well, life is filled with resurrections. I mean, there's a good pun there that I don't need to make. It's so obvious. But it's filled with them. Things that have the design of a rebirth. Eating. To be up here, to be upstairs working on this, and then Elise brings the food, and I go down, and just what I like, you know, the seeds, the sesame seeds and poppy seeds and all kinds of seeds on the chicken and the noodles, although they're kind of grungy then, but just, gah! You know, that's an Easter. That's a resurrection. Christ is risen. Risen indeed. You know. He's risen indeed. Indeed. Not just in word. Indeed. And okay, that thing had a vague resemblance to an Easter thing. It was a liberation for him. It was he came out of a darkness into a more of a real world. But it's not Easter. I mean, the connotations are false. And I think Kazantzakis meant to say that that was a very real Easter and not just looked like an Easter. I mean, that's maybe the surface of an Easter, but that's not the content of an Easter, you know? Okay, it's when the boss went to bed with the widow, even though it was liberating for him, it was not good news. It was not good news for the widow. Now, it was not bad news either. It wasn't bad news either. It was no news. It was no news. Just because it didn't seem bad news is not okay. A man has ways of covering up bad news, so if something doesn't look bad at the moment, doesn't mean that it doesn't put something bad in motion. Perhaps a fatherless child in 9 months, that could be better news. It could be better news. Hell is when there isn't joy at the birth of a baby. And I've had that joy today. And it could have been greater joy. There is joy. And it could have been even greater. Now, with something like birth control, we can bury the potential bad news. But damn it, a life of no news, a life of no news for the widow is bad news. Now, that ties up with something I've said before about, I've said to some individuals, and I don't know if I've said it to the whole thing, but not on any strength of my own, but with the strength of Christ, I can be more rather than less of what the person that you need to meet. I mean, there are situations to where a person, the consenting adult business, I can go around, you have to be an idiot not to find consenting adults to do anything you want to. I mean, you can advertise in any newspaper now. You know. It's ridiculous. And you go ahead and do that, but that is one, you're not, maybe not the person that that person needed to meet. You may be the personage that that personage thought they needed, but you won't be the person that they needed to meet. That we do live in a reality where we can be more or less the person that the next person we meet needs. We can be no news to them, bad news, good news. Those are some of our options. Now, one starves in terms of the widow, and I mean saying that life of no news for the widow is bad news. One starves and seeks out temporary good news. Water that quenches not in a string of very usual pleasures that really are pleasures. And it's very important not to go around saying that making love to voluptuous, hungry widows isn't a pleasure. Then you're being stupid and not full of folly. Of course it is. We have nothing to do with it. And that is one of the, and maybe that's the problem. Of course it's a pleasure, and we have nothing to do with it. Our persons have nothing to do with that being a pleasure. That was a footnote, by the way. It isn't developed in what I'm saying. But of course it is a pleasure. We have nothing to do with it. Temptations are never ugly. Now this, the first time I realized this, it was a shock to me. I always, you know, temptations are, of course, they're the beautiful things that are temptations. You know, who's tempted to get raped? I mean, you've got to, some people, but you got to be really perverted. You know? But who's tempted by whatever, you know, tall, dark, and handsome, short, thin, and ugly, whatever your image is, you know? You've got an image that's the temptation. It's going to look beautiful. It's not going to look ugly. They really are beautiful, you know? You know? Temptations are never ugly. We talked about that and when Ann Landers answered that one letter saying that all men were like evil Don Juans. No, they're not. You know, they're Sunday school superintendents. You know? No, really. And it isn't, you know, they say, aha, there's a Don Juan, those dirty guys. Look at that evil look in his eye. You know, well, some people are perverted enough to get excited about the evil look in the eye, but it's not like that. It doesn't come like that. It's nice guys. It's nice guys, nice girls, sad ones, lonely ones, you know. Temptations are never ugly. They're always beautiful. Some even look selfless. Some temptations even look selfless when you follow up on it. Like Zeus doing his selfless service for lonely people. You know, that was a beautiful thing. Very funny. Ha ha. You know, it was funny, you know. You don't meme yourself so you can't laugh at that kind of thing. And then Zorba being invited into heaven, well done, my good and faithful servant. You know, that was it's funny. But how it looks awfully good. I mean, he gives an argument, a very good sophist's argument there, because it looks like, hey, yeah, that's right, you know. And unless you've had any experience with that, and I have had experience with that kind of mentality, my own, having that feeling, you know, that there are a lot of lonely people, and you owe it to them to mean something to them, and to be something really, you know, unusual. And outside of Christ, that's it turns, the devil takes that outside of Christ, that very good, well-meaning thing, and just really wrecks, you know, wrecks havoc with it. Now, wrecks havoc with it. Now, don't ever use phrases like that. I don't even know what that phrase means. That's phrase tacking that Orwell would talk about. Wrecks havoc with it. Hits the nail on the head. That's poor use of language, I tell you. Zorba, being invited in to have well done my good and faithful servant. The point is, isn't for me to make it through life without suffering or doing no-nos. The point isn't to go through without suffering, nor is it to go through without doing no-nos. The point is to be good news. To be good news. And we can, if we are worried, like boss, about doing something wrong, we can almost guarantee that we will be no good news to anybody. The thirst for righteousness of Dimitri can keep him from being good news to anybody. Remember what happened to him? I mean, it was the exact opposite. He thirsted for righteousness, and he was going possessed, you know, running over everybody. It's not that it's good to do no-nos, and it's not that you seek suffering, but to be good news to people, the gospel to people, is the point. And those other things hopefully will follow too, but they're not the thing to be looking at. And boss really at the beginning fears suffering, and he fears doing. He's a guy that thirsts after a kind of righteousness. But the point is to be good news, not a Buddhist no news or old news or bad news, or a Zorba no news or old news or bad news, but good news, new news. And in a sense, Zorba is ancient news. I mean, he is a pre-conscience man, at the least at the beginning. Jesus taught with authority, with an authority that the doctors of law, psychology, ethics, theology, archetypal paganism didn't have. The doctors of those things didn't have. Now, who had a PhD in archetypal paganism? Zorba did. I mean, he had honorary doctorates from every, you know, he really did. He was a tremendous spokesman in that. But Christ had an authority that these didn't have. He had a new teaching, a new wine. He consorted with winebibbers and widows and didn't get smashed. He consorted with widows and prostitutes and didn't take them to bed. He was eternal good new news and not a temporary exciting bulletin, you know. Flash, the woman has hot pants, you know, or something like that. He was not a temporary bulletin that's dead tomorrow. He was not yesterday's newspaper. You know, not that. And this is one of the central points of the Samaritan woman at the well. To say there is everlasting water is not to say that regular water isn't a joy, a pleasure to drink and to contemplate. And that's one of the biggest screw-ups that the Christians have made, is to say that water is punk. It isn't punk. It's fantastic. It just doesn't quench. And there's no hope there. Drinking water is not the point. Zorba felt drinking as much water as possible in all its temporary forms was the point. It's not that that isn't great. It's just that that isn't the point. And that was Zorba's point. The voracious mouth. Zorba was dedicated to a life of eating. Eating. And I just told you I love eating, so I'm not against that. I mean, and really eating in private. No. The large, voracious mouth. That's a quote. Man's a brute, and he won't be satisfied till he eats men. That's a Zorba. Man's a brute, and he won't be satisfied until he eats men. Take, eat, this is my body given for you, my blood given to you. Feed my lambs, feed my sheep. The point is not to get rid of passion, but to change our lives from passion in eating the world to a passion for eating the word and feeding the world with the difference the good news makes. You don't have to continue a life of yesterday's news, which is no news. telling no news. This is not to say that passion is bad. In Christ, every meal is a feast, every day a drama of heaven and hell, acted out on the same stage. That's why Zorba isn't just a bad guy to sit in judgment on, nor his boss, but for different reasons. Zorba was passionately hungry for earthly food. You have to be passionately hungry for earthly food, or you won't be passionately hungry for heavenly food. Boss wasn't either. He was dispassionately hungry for getting rid of hunger in himself. And that was the Buddhist escape route, to get rid of hunger in himself. If you aren't overwhelmed by the beauty and ugliness of the world, how can you be overwhelmed by the beauty of the kingdom of heaven, or overwhelmed by the ugliness of the kingdom of hell? The sense, as something from Lewis, is that everybody you meet is going to heaven or to hell. If a person held that in their minds, it could make a difference. Maybe more good news would happen between men. Not necessarily talking about the gospel, but being, you know, the gospel with that recognition. Now, sometimes this crazy thing about the drama that's acted out, drama of heaven and hell acted out on the same stage, you've heard me say that the world that's ruled by the prince of darkness and the world that's ruled by the prince of light occupy the same space. Now, sometimes a drama of heaven and hell is acted out on the same stage, and sometimes even at the same moment. Now, right now I'm in joy that a baby has been born, and at the same time suffer at the circumstance of the birth. Now, I won't let the suffering steal my joy at the baby, and I cannot wax myself against the suffering and say that the news couldn't have been better. To do something in my head to get rid of the contradiction that one thing can be both beautiful and it happened in the circumstances that it happened, make you angry. Not to either just get angry and color everything black, and not just to say, oh, it's so wonderful and the joy of the child, and then say, well, it doesn't matter. But to be able to look at the drama that is being played out, both those things, and not chicken out. And in this case, that was just an example of this case. Okay. To be overwhelmed. If you don't eat the body of Christ, we eat each other. You've heard me say that again and again. That's so good, I think Carol must have said that first. I can't remember when it was, but it's just, poof. So if we don't eat the body and blood of Christ, we eat each other. And starve till death do part us from our hunger. I mean, we starve. Till death do part us from our hunger. If we eat the body and blood of Christ, we can feed each other what God is doing in our moments. And after our brothers and sisters eat, there will be baskets left over for us. Much, much left over for us. To look into the widow's eyes and to see what the Father in heaven is doing. Now, this is another hard thing to figure. This stuff, when I do feel like I did this afternoon writing this, you know, it's half poems and half essays, and so it's hard. But this, to look into the widow's eyes and see what the Father in heaven is doing, and not to see only what my blood is doing or her blood is doing. And now this sounds crazy, but also to look into my wife's eyes and see what she is doing and what our Father in heaven has his new one doing. That is love. Whether it takes the form of making love or not. Now, love is the point. Making love may or may not be part of its expression. But to love is the point. And you can think in your own, from literature and maybe from your own lives, where it's been, the point was the making love, and love was not at all the point. to look into the widow's eyes and see what the Father in heaven is doing and not see only what my blood is doing or her blood is doing, and this sounds very crazy, to look into my wife's eyes and see what she is doing and what our Father in heaven has his new one doing. That is love, whether it takes the form of making love or not. Love is the point. Making love may or may not be part of its expression. This love may or may not be the substance of what we call making love in a marriage, but it will not be the substance of making love outside of marriage. Outside of marriage and inside of marriage, there may be a great deal of passion, which may be beautiful and seem to blot out the hunger and loneliness of human existence. There may be a great deal of glad animal happiness in wait, but this water does not quench and the drinking starts turning. That drinking starts turning what was meant to be a gift for a new one into demand or counter-demand. And this is hard. It's on tape if you want to listen to this again. Because this is really packed. But it turns. Not that it isn't beautiful. Milk is wonderful. But it turns. It sours. And thinking in literature and in maybe in your own lives, that how it turns into demand instead of gift, into demand or counter demand of two people, not a new one, but two people with different bills of rights. And we will start being chained to a false well whose springs are fed by chance and circumstance and not by grace. That the one of the things that in here using this marriage thing is that there's lots of beauty, there's lots of water there, they're fed by springs of chance and circumstance and not by grace. Zorba went to Russia and got married. Good for him. I wish earlier in his life he had looked to see what his Father in heaven was doing and not look to see what his devil was doing. There's a passage in there where he talks about emptying of the devil and then the guy dies. Zorba looking to see what his devil was doing, and the image that had sovereignty over his life was who? Satan? No. The image of Zorba. The image of Zorba. Self-image. The image of Zorba ruled him. The young Zorba, the pre-conscience man, a pre-conscience man. Now, to have no conscience, you have to keep moving. And what was Zorba doing? Remember in the book. To have no conscience, you have to keep moving. You can't go back to the town where you slit the priest's throat. You may see his children, and you may see yours. And what Zorba did then is tear off the Saint Sophia that he had on his chest, tear it off and throw it away, and I think in the strong name of not being a hypocrite, then ran away from, I mean, he turned a corner there that was more than just running away from the army. He saw at least that hypocrisy, but he thought that he ought to break that kind of connection completely, because after all, men are brutes. And he didn't need to make that conclusion. Okay. To have no conscience, you have to keep moving. You can't go back to the town where you slit the priest's throat. Now, in a society where we're moving and everybody moves every 5 years, it's kind of funny, isn't it? We have a mobility that's just implied. It's available. And one of the, I think somebody ought to do a study on what the effect of mobility has on mores of a country. I mean, if you're going to live in a little Iowa town, your name becomes very important, and you stand for something, and you just don't do certain things. And you get hopelessly righteous, too, in the little Iowa towns, but also certain things don't maybe happen so easily. But if you want to have no conscience, you have to keep moving. Zorba started running that day. He says, I started running that day and I have never stopped. But when he did stop, as he did in this book with Boss, his conscience began to hurt him again and again. It just peak up, you know. He'd say, wait a minute, I'm a rotter. You know, what am I doing? I'm taking Boss's money and I'm doing this thing and I, And his conscience did begin to hurt as soon as he quit running. And what have I done to Boss? And man is a brute. He'd talk about the war and so forth. He ends up being sorry for man, and especially for women. He offers another system. Now, you'll have to follow this one through. I don't develop it in here too much. But he offers another system like the Grand Inquisitor based on humanitarian pity. Remember? The Grand Inquisitor's system was based on humanitarian pity, and to Dostoevsky, humanitarian pity was another word for Antichrist. Much of what Zorba is talking about is humanitarian pity. Man loses, and the funny thing is that its irony is the same as in Dostoevsky, is in this humanitarian pity, man loses his dignity. I mean, to the Grand Inquisitor, and to Zorba, what does he say about man? Does God care if one earthworm sleeps with another earthworm's wife? Or if the earthworms weren't married? We're these dinky little, you know, we're these insects. Does he give a damn? Let's out of pity, Zorba says, Grand Inquisitor says, ask nothing of anyone and find what little happiness and comfort we can. The passionate heart of Zorba made that a lot of happiness because of the extent of his passion. It made it a lot of happiness and comfort, but temporal always, and he kept running. Now, the funny thing is that his manliness, he was so much a man, his manliness kept temporal meals always within his reach. I mean, he was so different from everybody else in the book that he was getting plenty of temporal meals. Boss would have starved to death for that routine. But for Zorba, as for all of us, it's harder for the rich in anything to enter the kingdom of heaven. You know, and boy, Zorba is the richest person, you know, one of the richest persons in passion that there is. And it's true for him, it's true for us. It's harder for the rich in anything to enter the kingdom of heaven. Rich in talent, whatever. Sometimes I think Mary, the mother of Jesus, must have been ugly, retarded, crippled, no personality, no outward fire, and she probably never left the kingdom of heaven. For the gospel, that's the kind of gospel, that the weak shall be exalted, and weak in all, poor in all sorts of things. And contrary to the image that is one gets out of the Catholic Church to really, that at least the Catholics that I've known, is that she's pure, perfect, everything is just, you know, on her own, she was perfect. You know, as a woman, all perfect. And, well, maybe that, there, I guess there's a theological case you can make there. Anyway, that's a stupid digression. The point is, we place our hope in our riches. If we do, we keep thinking our comfort, happiness, and justification comes through our riches. We do this unconsciously. Our riches are the greatest temptation. This is true for Zorba, and it's true for us. And he had to worry about passion and a kind of charisma that just went with him, overpowered people. We've got to remember that reading Zorba especially, that no one ever said that man couldn't live 70 years of relative excitement, comfort, happiness without Christ. No one ever said that you couldn't live 70 years of excitement, comfort, and happiness without Christ, and pile up hundreds of good memories and maybe even a liberating, happy memory for many other people due to the timidity and dryness and loneliness of many. It's so great. But man outside of Christ has to forget so much and or run so fast to keep ahead of guilt, and if not guilt, corpses. To be a blessed memory is more than to be a memory. To be a blessed memory is more than to be remembered. Being remembered is not the point, but that people be blessed with the impossible possibility of Christ's perfect love that casts out the fear of never having lived and the fear of having starved till death. Problem. What does looking into the widow's eyes, or perhaps away from her eyes, to find what the Father is doing mean? What does that mean? It's a very hard question. It's been asked a number of times already. We can be helped a bit toward an answer by using the words author and writing. One of the ways of talking about God was the author of our being. Well, author and writing. We give up authorship of our life. I no longer look into the widow's eyes to see what I am going to write next, or to see what she is hoping or planning to write next in my life, but to see what chapter God, my author, is writing at that moment. The answers don't come in words, but in very common responses, no violins, but very common responses at very unusual times and situations. It's very much like a parable. Do we pay taxes to Caesar? Got a quarter? Strange response. Christ is always saying, I'm looking to see what my Father is doing. And that didn't mean that he had a life without passion. God's imagination and vision is much greater than ours. The creativity of the continuing Creator, the Creator who continues creating, is much greater than ours. We sacrifice authorship and he writes a far better story. We rebel against his authorship often and are responsible for what we write alone. And the funny, great thing is that God only writes comedies. Christ's life defies, though, it literary classification. Christ's life is another story. Stands outside of what I'm going to say. Men write tragedies. Tragedies. Remember that circle I drew once. Men write tragedies where a man thought he was more than human, and was brought down from his particular form of arrogance to shatter on the human. Or men write pathetic histories where they start out human and sink below and stay under human, settling for less than the human in resignation or self-pity. Or men write fantasies where they cast themselves as hero and see an unearthly, mysterious light about their lives. Body and blood is not enough here. These folks tend to love the big H humanity but can't stand people, or if they seem to like people, it's really the idea of the person that is liked, but not the reality. This, I think, is the home of the waxers and cosmetic users. God writes comedies. Now, we all tend, all of us, me, I'm all these guys. I'm a tragedy writer, a pathos writer, and a fantasy writer. But hopefully that's not all. We tend to write tragic, pathetic, and fantastic lives for ourselves. God writes comedies that raise us up to real bread and wine, body and blood. God knows that since the fall, the human is above us. The human is above us. Now that's a hard thought. God knows that since the fall, the human is above us. He wants to raise us up to the human, make honest, individual men and women out of us. I passionately desire to be human. Even a centipede passionately desires to live. And of course, to be human implies to live. But passionately desire to be human. And that changes the subject from passionately desiring life and then living a life, you know, saying, well, life means this kind of activity and this, and then you go out and get as much as you can. That's one way of being. But to passionately desire to be human, it's a different ballgame. And this, to glorify God is to make men whole, to make men whole is to glorify God, implies that we are not human yet. And Carol has said before, this isn't just me talking, I think there's plenty of theology, sound theology behind it. but that Christ was not only the only Christian, he was the only man that ever walked the earth. Since Adam and Eve before the fall. Now, boy, there's nothing in here that says let the fire go out. You know, have that fire burn. Don't let your passion go out. It's a passion to be human. The fire, we got something down here. Don't let the fire within go out, but pray to have the door open. And don't, in the midst of the world's woes, quit celebrating. You know that in the 60s, in all the protest stuff, it was like at its worst, it was the new Puritans, new self-righteousness, no celebration. How can I eat meat? How can I eat when they're starving? Remember Carol saying it's really important when in prison camp with no food, 116 pounds, weighed as much as Elise does. You know, Carol weighs as much as Elise and she's no chub. You know, praying that the people at home wouldn't quit celebrating because they were in prison. That, you know, it's a revolution. Celebration is revolutionary. Now, in the face of the world's woes, don't quit celebrating, because I was talking to somebody else today about that a little bit. But if I cannot celebrate what is here, I'm not going to be a person who will be doing anything that there. I have to have the passionate response of celebration and suffering in this moment, right here, within my reach, or I'm not the kind of person to do any good over there anyway. This has to happen first. If this doesn't happen, forget it. It's just a daydream to think that I'm going to do any good anywhere else. I'm going to be no good news, that's for sure. But good news is involved in celebrating and hurting, and not just one or the other, you know, with what's at hand. And now if someone is, should I allow someone who is suffering in front of me to steal my celebration? Well, it's not, that's a whole other question. That isn't even stealing celebration. The person there is what's at hand. And I can celebrate that person best, but now doesn't it look like holy hilarity? You know, this kind of, you know, ooh-hoo-ee, you know. Because that's throwing shit in the person's face. Because no one's a fool, and if somebody is sitting there suffering, if I'm going around going, like, you know, I'm calling that person a fool, and Christ said, call no one a fool. That comes from somewhere, and I can celebrate that person. And hurt with them, but not if they ask for food, give them stones of no news, bad news. You know, listen, you really have to stay where, you know, this, or to give them that feeling like there isn't possibility. To give the good news of the impossible possibility that there is renewal coming. There is hope. Sometimes just shut up. I mean, sometimes best way to be with a person is just to shut up. And you've got to pray that the Lord provide words, because you can't choose them. You can't consciously choose the right words. I consciously wanted to choose 15 minutes of words to say about the whole book, just kind of do a real hot shot lit crit, you know, tum, tum, there you go. And that's dumb. I'm glad that didn't happen. May have bored you to tears, but this is what the book is about. It cooks with our life and just, you know, shakes the whole thing. And that's just one place.
to touch down. I feel free in going ahead and doing this. Is this like the last session? Because you know, you better know by now, that these discussions are only 10%. 90% has got to go on outside. I was talking to Tom. There are 15 or 16 or 17 individual discussions to be had on this book. If I talked about any one of them, or we talked about any one of them, it wouldn't have been right. But there are 24 hours in the day. And you know who to talk to about something in the book that bothers you or wants to make you sing. And you know who to talk to. And keep the talk going. You know, this book is not over. This book has just started. How can I sit there and how do you praise Zorba enough? How do you say, Zorba, don't? With that much charisma, you've got to get your... You better... He's got so much appeal. A person with a lot of appeal like that has got to pray a lot, not to lead innocence over the edges of cliffs, not to kill. I mean, if he, again, could Zorba have done what he did in his town? He would have seen the damages, the wake of his damages. Christ comes that we may be Zorba without the wake of damages. As long as you look at Zorba, you love him. It's when you look at the wake of his youth that you hate him. We can't get confused because we see an old Zorba who's long been sifting at the end and then goes and marries his, what's the last wife's name? Something. We needn't. We have it written down. We have it written down. It's from Hebrews, I think. You know. It's in Romans too. You know. We have it written down. We don't have to go for a life of 70 years of chance and circumstance to come to a point where we are more good news people than just plain bad news or no news. And Zorba, by chance, without any having anything written down, works his way through to toward the end to something that you can run with for a while. At least nothing is said that you know. It's so vague there at the end that you don't know. But that wake of damages that he leaves is the wake of like a ship, you know, going through life and just, you know, and he's got some people that don't know what hurt him but have not had any good news, and then has concrete hurt, destroyed people behind him. And that's not something that, we have to consider that too. And maybe you guys don't get that excited about Zorba, but boy, you know, I see that kind of the passion, that seeing things for the first time, that, boy, I want to preach that. That's what I'm preaching. Some of the things that Zorba says is lifestyle enrichment. You know? Some of the things he says is what lifestyle enrichment is about. And some of the other things he says are, you know, what the devil's about. And it isn't so much that God and the devil are the same, but in Zorba, there is that same. You know? He's got a holy hilarity about him that I love. He's got wisdom, and he's got just not a baptized foolishness. He's a real, you know, foolishness. And because he is so attractive, he's got to be careful. He's so rich. Anybody who is rich in anything, hi, you want to walk in front of me? That'll teach you. Anybody who is rich in anything, pray about that richness. I'm sure that Rich would say this, his temptations are going to come through art. My temptations are going to come through words. you know? Through words and passion. If I didn't, I've got to pray more that the words are right and the truths are right. Because if it's down, I'm going to preach, you know, preach anything. So I better have the right subject, because I wouldn't want to come within, you know, 100 miles of me if I didn't have the right subject. Because I'm a preacher. But my goodness, we are a dream that won't come true outside of Christ. We are a dream that won't come true outside of Christ. But we have to remember that God is the keeper of that dream, and that it is hidden in Christ, revealed, incarnated in the moments that are flowing toward us. He who catches and keeps is lost. Christ fills our hungers so that we don't grab one thing so hard we drown the things that are the salvation of our spirit. The salvation of our spirit is bread and wine, body and flesh, body and blood of Christ. Then we don't have to grab one piece so hard and destroy the whole person in the process. He sees things originally, has a child's eyes and a man's depth. There's a difference. It's not just a child's eyes. He has a man's depth. Depth in a man is in accordance with what he has lost. It's in accordance with what he has lost. The more lost, the more had. The more had, the more lost. Love means suffering. If you don't want to suffer, don't love. The pigeon walking. Beautiful thing. Pigeon walking. Does anybody know where that is in the book? Pigeon walking. Remember the stories Robert told? It's just beautiful. Okay. Bought the pigeon. I think it's a pigeon. Wanted to walk like something else and ended up not being able to. Is it a peacock?
Yeah.
You know where that is?
I think it's towards the beginning. I'm not sure.
And he says, "Boss, that's what you're like."
Page 67? Yeah. Yeah. In the middle of 67.
Oh, like a crow, huh? There's a... And he's beautiful. Beautiful lines. Zorba keeps coming up with these choice things that I want to, you know, remember this. It's so true. And then this other thing is, damn it, Zorba. You know, come on, be the Superman I want you to be. And only be a, you know, be a, you know, don't be ambiguous, you know, really do it. Like this, tell me what you do with the food you eat and I'll tell you who you are. Some turn their food into fat and manure, some into work and good humor. And others, I'm told, into God. So there must be three sorts of men. I'm not one of the worst, boss, nor yet one of the best. I'm somewhere between the two. What I eat, I turn into work and good humor. And that's not too bad after all. That's really nice. I don't think there's that three kinds of men. I think that turning turning the food into certain kind of work, into certain kind of good humor is doing this God's job here. Zorba has a real sick understanding that the devil sends all the pretty women and the God sends all the ugly ones. That's his idea. All the things that we enjoy, the devil gives. All the things that we don't like, God has for us. You know, that's sick. But anyway, as for you, boss, I think you do your level best to turn what you eat into God. But what you can't
quite manage, but you can't quite manage it, and that torments you. The same thing's happening to you as happened to the crow. What happened to the crow? Well, you see, he used to walk respectably, properly, well, like a crow. One day he got it into his head to try and strut about like a pigeon. And from that time on, the poor fellow couldn't for the life of him recall his own way of walking. He was all mixed up, don't you see? He just hobbled about. Now, meaning of persons is about that. I would say, though, you know how Zorba has the image of the self in there? He wants to walk like that image of Zorba. That isn't right. Because an image that I come up with for myself is going to be a personage. When I can have the person of Christ, you know, be the image that has sovereignty, you know, in my imagination. But I have to be careful not to make some kind of a skinny aesthetic. What did Rich say the other night? You know, a girl with a beard, you know, out of Christ. A girl with a beard, like some of these sort of, you know, person that never looks down to the ground is always looking up. I mean, it's not that. Christ has a lot to do with good humor and work, and it doesn't have so much to do with our typical sort of fuzzy ideas of God. That thing that is so good from Ferdy's book, which we'll do this spring, is, you know, God doesn't want to know what he's like in us to know what he's like in heaven. He wants us to know what he's like here. You know? And our conceptions of God, I think we allow that to be a mystery. And I have Christ, who is the manifestation of him, and for my understanding. And who God is, as far as I can tell, is all in Christ. And he is Christ. And that's that. And now look to Christ and not project. Almost any common understanding of Christ shatters in the New Testament. You know, Christ wasn't a holy man. That's why he was crucified. He wasn't a holy man. He wasn't a holy man enough. He wasn't. The Pharisees wanted a holy man. He broke the Sabbath. He talked with the whores and prostitutes, stuff like that. Oh, there's so much here. Well, continue the talk on this. Really, 90% has to happen before the discussions begin. That means you got to read the books really well before the discussions begin. I think I want to send out a kind of a list for you to check, anonymous things to when did you have the books done, you know, were they done before the thing started, were they done while the thing was going on at the end, or have you, are they done at all? I really want to see, you know, all, you know, where that sets, because the connections between these books are very important to be made. And you learn things with contact with it, and you can't, and it isn't just Tournier when you find it in Zorba, and it isn't just Zorba when you find it in Tournier or Dostoevsky, and it isn't just anything when you find all of it in the greater gospel. And those connections, to keep those connections going, it's really important. Okay, well, that's, I sure didn't think it was going to go that long. But let the conversation begin on Zorba. I certainly am not done with it. I just, Sam woke up and I had to stop. I mean, it's just, you know. And it isn't distance. It's not this objective sort of hold it off there and then play with it, manipulate it. I mean, that thing, it really stirs you up and you think things that you've never thought before and express things that you never
knew you had to express. And it's something to get started. Having to write something like I read to you is lifestyle enrichment. You know, that's what lifestyle enrichment is about. So I mean, it's the first 9 months of life enrichment, and that's this is what it looks like. What I've just said to you, to have to do that.